You're listening to Building the Game with Rob and Jason.
It's Building the Game with Jason and Rob. For tabletop game design, you really can't go wrong. Building the game, yeah, building the game.
Hello and welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today is Monday, December 14th, 2015. You're listening to episode 185. My name is Rob. With me, Jason.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good. You're not going to do that voice the whole time, are you? Because I don't want to make a podcast if you're going to.
All right. Do you want me to start over?
No, it's great for the intro.
Okay.
Yeah. I just don't want to listen to you make that voice when we're trying to talk.
Okay. Well, I guess I won't then. Sorry. Did I say 185? Did I get that right?
I think you did. Wow.
I'm getting there. After 185 episodes, I'm starting to remember.
It's impressive when you do that.
What number on? I think the worst mistake we ever made was counting.
Yeah, when you said the same episode twice in a row, and then we like skipped to the next one. Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
Yeah,
woohoo, go team!
Right. So yeah, doing this again. What's new?
Not a lot. I've been playing games a lot lately, which is exciting.
Like what?
We got the basement all set up down here. So we bring the kids down and we let them play.
Clean and organized.
And then we sit here and we play games. So what have we played lately? We played Zombie Dice, which is, I mean,
it's a fun little game. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like going to change your life or anything, but it's really just play. My wife really likes it. It's a pressure lock game. I mean, everybody pretty much knows how Zombie Dice works. It's like the quintessential pressure lock dice game.
Yeah.
So we've been playing that. Also played some games of Best Treehouse Ever.
Good.
Which is only my, like, second and third time playing that.
I played one time in Unpub and it's fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's funny, I was explaining it to Steph and my mom, and you could tell my mom was like, this is confusing, and I'm like, just wait. Like, and within like two rounds of the game, she's like, oh, I get it. Okay.
Yeah, it's
not confusing.
Good.
So yeah, it's a really easy to play game. I love the artwork on it. There's so many Easter eggs on there, like just looking at the artwork where it's like, oh, that's Adam McIver as a kid with a fake beard. That's awesome. Or Nick Offerman is one of the kids.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a kid with a huge mustache who's working in a wood shop.
That's funny.
Because Nick Offerman in real life is a big woodworker.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I thought that was pretty funny. Just some other random things. And I'm like, oh, good Easter eggs. Way to go.
Cool.
Yeah, so what else did we play? We played that, Zombie Dice, and I feel like we played one other game with everybody. Maybe not. Well, we tried to play Phantom of the Opera, but I realized I forgot how to play that. And trying to read that while the kids were trying to like cause mayhem, I was like, okay, I don't understand when this stuff happens, so let's not play it. So I'll explain it to her again, because we used to play it a lot, so it's just been like a year since we played it. So I'm like, I'll explain it to you sometime when it's just us, and then we'll play it, and then we'll be good to play it when the kids are around, because you'll know how to play. It's not a game that takes a lot of concentration to play.
Or it can take a whole lot of concentration to think about what you're learning.
If you really want to overthink
it. You really need to, I mean, if you're going to play it smartly, then it helps to analyze it and remember a lot of the information.
Right.
Yeah.
We also played Brave Rats, and that wasn't very fun. And it's a good game, so I think we played it wrong. I think we're doing it wrong.
Okay.
Because when I played it with Katarski before, I loved it, so I bought it. And then I played it with her, and it wasn't fun at all. It was very predictable, so I think...
I think you're doing something wrong.
I think we were doing it wrong. And I think now I know how we were doing it wrong. So I'll reread the rules and try that again, because it's a lot of fun. And but
theoretically,
not when you play it wrong. Yeah, theoretically, it's a good time.
Yeah.
So there's that. That's cool. Exciting.
Great.
That's what I've been doing. What have you been doing?
Not a ton. I'm reading book two in the Harry Dresden series.
Yeah,
it's pretty good. Those are good books. It's good books. I like that first one a lot, and the second one is, I think I'm liking a little bit more.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I watched that show, the Dresden Files TV show. That was a season or a season and a half or something.
Yeah. Was the show good?
Yeah, it was good. We liked it. It was weird, and I think it got canceled before it really found its feet.
Yeah.
But
happens a lot.
Yeah, but we enjoyed it quite a bit. I think it was just one season. But yeah.
It was good. And there's some differences, of course, between the book and the show. But yeah, I'm digging that.
That's something to be said for the Netflix shows. Is I don't feel like they have a hard time finding their feet because they're able to plan out basically a 12-hour movie.
Yeah.
And then just make that as mm-hmm. a season. And yeah. I feel like that, whereas your network TV doesn't get a chance to do that because mm-hmm. it's on demand, right? It's like,
right.
Here's the first episode. Here's the second episode. Here's the third episode. Oh, we're still shooting the fifth episode. Oh, we're trying this. We're trying that. With this, it's like, let's figure out this big story and yeah. make it a one season deal and then do it. And I think that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. It is great
about that.
It's so great. Yeah. We didn't talk about Jessica Jones on the show yet. We've both finished it now.
Yeah. It's fantastic. I mean,
it's great.
I enjoyed Daredevil more.
Oh, really?
But only because I really like the action scenes in Daredevil. They made that show the best thing that it was, mm-hmm. right? There was drama in it, but the drama was better in Jessica Jones. The mm-hmm. fighting was better, I think, in Daredevil. One of the things that I had a hard time believing in Daredevil, I mean, in Jessica Jones, was how she didn't die when she would get beat up by people, especially the super strong people she'd get beat up by, because they kept telling us that she wasn't any physically tougher than a normal person. She was just super strong.
Well, they did say at one point later in the series, and this is not a spoiler, they did say at one point she said that she heals faster than most people.
Oh, did she say that? Okay.
Yeah. It was just she said it real quick. No big deal.
Okay. So
I think...
So
that implies that she heals quickly. She probably with that has a pain tolerance and
The pain tolerance I can believe because she's tough. Yeah. Like she toughs it out, right?
Right.
She's
right.
Like whatever.
Yeah, part of her strength.
I think one of my favorite lines in the show is Luke Cage says to her, you know, he's talking about how good their powers are, right? And he says, mm-hmm. "Can you stop a moving car?" And she said, "A slow moving car." And it's just so honest, right? Yeah. It's just so honest, and they handle superpowers in that show very
well.
Well.
Yeah.
Just the practical uses that she has for the mm-hmm. superpowers and mm-hmm. how she just uses them like mm-hmm. it's no big deal,
mm-hmm.
and I love that.
Yeah.
Because she's not wearing a costume. Mm-hmm. Did she ever wear a costume during this series?
No, there's one call out to that where they joke about her wearing a costume.
Right.
But yeah. But no, like, she never actually puts one on.
I was bummed. I actually, because they had said originally we were going to get to see her in like a flashback to her costume.
No, huh?
So that makes me wonder when they do the Defenders series, will she wear a costume?
I hope not.
I kind of hope not too, but how dorky is Daredevil going to look wearing a costume?
Well, he looks pretty dorky.
I know, but right. I know you hate his costume, but like, think about it. Because like Luke Cage, I don't feel like he'd be wearing a costume either. Because he's in this series and he's getting his own series.
Yeah. I've said many times before that I prefer Daredevil in his black pants, black shirt, you know,
but the
black
thing
stocking
is,
cap.
He's still wearing a costume. So I'd rather he wear a cool costume than a homemade costume.
Well, see, the difference there though for me was that he was wearing, you know, like workout clothes
mm-hmm.
that were practical, that he was wearing them just to not get in his way, you know? And to the mask was to protect his identity and hide the fact that he's blind, right?
Right.
That I thought that was really smart, really intelligent, and it felt very natural.
Right.
And I mean, they wrote his costume into the show, of course. But I thought when we went from that kind of cool, practical, real world sort of ensemble to comic book superhero costume, it felt a little disingenuous.
I get you.
It felt forced.
I think if Jessica Jones had been first, it would have felt more disingenuous, but it didn't bother me.
Yeah.
What'll be interesting is Iron Fist. They're doing that. And Iron Fist's costume is his superhero costume is basically Daredevil's first costume with more colors in it.
Oh, yes.
I mean, realistically,
Iron Fist at all.
So that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. There were sometimes when we were watching Jessica Jones, because these are smaller, lower tier heroes that I don't know anything about.
Right.
And something would happen and Christine would like turn to me and she's like, "He's not dead, is he?" And I'd say, "I honestly don't know. I don't know this character's story at all.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So. And then who is this guy? Is this a guy? I'm like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Is this a guy? I don't know if this is a guy.
That one you're talking about?
I looked him up later, yeah.
Is totally. Well, that's like her best friend, Trish, is one of Marvel's oldest characters.
Yeah.
Like she was, and they actually, I guess she had a comic book series, like a teenage dorky comic book series.
Yeah.
And they make reference to them having a comic book series about her in the show, and that was fantastic. Yeah. Like, what a great reference.
It's really funny.
She was also a great character.
She was.
Like, she was a good, like, not quite sidekick, but still not helpless, right?
Sure.
Like,
yeah, she was really good. Really, really well, yeah. Kilgrave definitely is the most terrifying bad guy in any of the Marvel stuff ever.
And, you know, he is. And one of the things that was really interesting was they had pointed out this review I was reading, and this doesn't spoil anything, but they're like, this guy could just walk into the White House and just take over. But it would never occur to him, because why bother? Why not just have the perfect life,
sure,
having what you want where you are? I mean, what was interesting was, I don't think he ever like was rich. You know what I mean? Like, he just was like, I'll go get this money that I need. Now I have the money that I need. Now I will do this. You know what I mean? It wasn't So that was interesting. He's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And David Tennant was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
There were some things like towards the end where I felt like I almost expected like Daredevil to show up and I would have been okay with that.
Yeah.
Just because, like, Kilgrave was making enough news, it felt like, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That someone
seems like
would
someone
have
else would
like...
have noticed. Yeah, yeah. So on that. So comparing the two, like, I agree with you. Daredevil, the action, the fighting was a lot better than Jessica Jones.
I think it's the best we've seen in the Marvel universe.
I agree. Yeah, it was top notch. Yeah. We've never seen anything better. And it had a lot of really excellent character stuff. I think Jessica Jones also had good action and good fights, but of course it wasn't about that. You know, it's right about the character stuff. So the character stuff was better, but I'm on the fence, but I think I am leaning a little bit more towards liking the end of Daredevil a bit more. How that wrapped up. I mean, Jessica Jones was excellent, but I feel like I liked the ending of Daredevil just a touch better than the ending of Jessica Jones.
See, I actually would be the opposite.
Oh, really?
I would say I liked Daredevil overall, but the end of Jessica Jones I thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
The way, like, clearly we know where it's going now, mm-hmm, like on multiple fronts. And mm-hmm, for a Netflix show, I actually thought that was cool because they don't always do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Daredevil was kind of an open-ended ending, right? Like,
sure,
you kind of know what's going to happen, but you don't, I mean, mm-hmm, it just was.
Yeah. I'm thinking about the final climactic conflict scene.
Oh, see, I still think that was better in Jessica Jones.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of knew what was going to happen at the end. Like, there were no surprises in that last scene, but it was still really cool. Sure. You're like, oh, I know what's going to happen. Yeah.
It's like, if one is 90%, the other one is 89%.
Yeah. I mean, it was really close.
Just barely.
I think one of my other favorite lines is there's a scene in the show where Kilgrave is not telling someone what to do. He's waiting for them to do what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually says, how do you live like this? Just mm-hmm sitting around hoping people do what you want them to do.
Yeah.
That so sums up his character because that's so foreign to him because he just tells people to do it and they do it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he was in that scene, he had decided not to. Mm-hmm. That's all I'll say about it. But it was comical to me. It was very.
Yeah, it's real good. So, two for two, though, on that stuff.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite characters, and this is probably a spoiler, so I guess I won't say it, but is, the person she dealt with a lot, who was not a hero, you know what I'm talking about,
yep,
right?
I do. Yep.
By the end, that was one of my absolute favorite characters.
Oh yeah.
So great. Such a good turning points, and it was brilliant.
One of the best.
Yeah. Yep. So, that's something that makes me excited for the next season.
Yeah.
So
definitely.
That was really cool. Since we're talking movies, did you see the trailer for Civil War?
I did.
Better than you expected?
No, I mean, I figured it'd be a good trailer.
So
yeah, I mean, Marvel, Disney cuts a good trailer, you know?
The fight scene at the end between Winter Soldier, Captain, and Iron Man looked pretty cool.
It looked a little artificial to me.
You know why it looks? I actually watched it like four times because I felt like that too. And you know what the thing is? You're not used to Iron Man doing that. I think that's what it is it's weird to see Iron Man fist fighting someone.
Well, that's true.
Because that's not what he does. So what I liked about that was it was kind of stretching. Like, I like when they show, like, they did this sometimes in Jessica Jones where when she would fight, she would do something. And you're like, well, that's what somebody with super strength would do who is like in a dirty fight, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I liked that. I kind of felt the same way with that, where it was like, he's like fighting and he like blasts one of them as he's punching. 'Cause you're Iron Man. Why don't you do that?
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, overall, I thought it was really slick.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like in that trailer, they should have dispelled any concerns people had about, like, how is Captain America going to be on this side, and how is Tony Stark? Like, I feel like the trailer, to, at least from my mind, put that to rest as to this totally makes sense as to why this is this and that is that.
I disagree with that. I don't think they
really?
They addressed that enough to say, you know, why are these guys opposed to each other? I don't think they did that.
I mean, like, the idea of Tony being on the side of registration or whatever that side is, and I don't think it'll be exactly registration, but whatever that side is, Tony being on that, I've bought that from the beginning. I think it makes sense because he's seen what the problems he's caused, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very personal for him. And for Tony Stark, if it's personal, it actually matters to him. Otherwise, he doesn't get it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why he keeps doing stupid things. But for Cap, I felt like that trailer did a good job of showing... I think in Cap's mind, whenever he, like, when they show the scene where they were taking away their stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, to him, like, he's going to have the World War II Nazi flashbacks, right? Like, anytime that happens, that's what he equates that to, right? Because that's his world mindset, is if somebody is oppressing us by taking our stuff and telling us we have to have this, he automatically is going to equate that to that type of situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Cap fights for freedom, right?
Right.
You know, and freedom in all forms, and he fights for the American ideals even when the American government is ignoring its own ideals. So that's kind of his
right. He's the pure.
He's the purest idealist.
I mean, he was basically ever. Around when they wrote the Constitution. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He's right. He fights for truth and justice in even when it's the wrong time to fight for that.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, so anyways, I'm excited. I also read that Robert Downey Jr. signed on for Infinity War.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh.
So he's not going anywhere.
Could be a flashback.
It could be, but I mean, they would be
rumors
stupid.
Because rumor is that he's going to die in this.
See, and if I had to pick one, I would say that Cap would die, but he's supposed to be in Infinity War as well.
Yeah, I think killing Iron Man is the right choice, personally. I think it's the right choice because he started all this. He's kind of the... He's the Han Solo, right? He's not necessarily the main hero, but he's everyone's favorite hero. He started everything. The Iron Man movie came first. Robert Downey Jr. is the face of these Marvel movies, right?
Big time.
So I understand why Disney would not want him to go, but narratively, it's the most powerful death. That character dying is the most powerful death you could put into that
and even
period.
Even within the universe, like, if there was something that was going to bring Cap back, like, what have I done? Having Iron Man die would probably do that.
Yeah. Right.
It would make me sad because he's so fun, right? Like, I mean, he's the most, but I would say, well, he's the face. Captain America is a very close second.
He is now,
movies
because
his movies have been so good. I think that's why.
He is that now, and he's. I think he's a worthy successor.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, Cap 2 was kind of the best Marvel movie. I think.
I think it is the best Marvel movie. Period. The second most was Cap 1. Personally, after that is Iron Man 3 for me.
I think I would say the same thing, but I would replace Cap 1 with Guardians of the Galaxy because I loved Guardians of the Galaxy. I mean, it had its flaws, but it was them taking a risk and doing something and that huge payoff.
Yeah.
I would say in my top five, I would include Ant-Man because Ant-Man was such a surprise.
Yeah.
I expected it to be good, but I didn't expect it to be as great as it was.
Yeah. I would probably put Guardians at 4 and Ant-Man at 5. Yeah.
We're pretty close then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Iron Man 3 was just
really good.
Shane Black, man. I mean, he knows what he's doing.
Really good.
Oh, one thing I was going to say that I thought was cool about Jessica Jones was you're always talking about like superheroes. I don't know, kind of the nerdy side. You want to know like who's better at this and who's better at that. Like, well, you know, Thor is stronger than Cap, but Cap has a shield, right? And the shield basically absorbs anything Thor does. Or the Hulk is super strong, but he can't lift Thor's hammer, right?
Yeah, now, to be fair, you're saying you don't mean me. Like, I don't wonder about that. You think the broad you.
I don't wonder about that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm saying, like, when I see those things in the movies, I like that. Like, I like that, like, in Avengers 1 when Hulk tries to pick up the hammer and he's like breaking through the floor because he's so strong, but he still can't pick up the hammer because that's life, right? So I love those things, right? Like, mm-hmm. Those are the type of Easter eggs that really do it for me in movies, the Marvel movies especially. Mm-hmm. So, like, I was constantly like, so Jessica Jones is stronger than Luke Cage, right? Like, but he's indestructible, so, well, theoretically.
Unbreakable
right?
skin. I mean,
yeah, he has unbreakable skin, that's what it is. So, but he's also stronger than your average person.
Yeah, he's
but he's
a
not
tough
as strong
dude.
As she is.
Yeah, that's so, that's what I've learned from the show anyway.
Right, yeah. yeah. So, because when I'd read about his powers ahead of time, it was like, he's super strong and he's got unbreakable skin. And I was like, oh, well, that's like, that's the same thing she has, except for she doesn't have unbreakable skin. But in the show, they make it clear that she is stronger.
She's stronger, yeah.
Which I thought was a nice touch to
yeah, it's
kind
cool.
of like, you mm-hmm. know, everybody has to have, like, Daredevil is not stronger or unbreakable, but mm-mm. I guarantee he could whip either of them in a fight because he's Daredevil. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
he's, I mean, he's got the moves. He's better trained.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Put it that
yeah.
way. He has so, better training than they
right.
do. Yeah.
Just thinking, if you had to pair up a fight, you know, Ant-Man is actually, like, pretty tough because of the shrinking thing.
Uh-huh.
I feel like Daredevil would just, like, destroy him.
Ant-Man so far is definitely the weakest of the heroes. I mean, flat out, right?
He's the weakest, but, like, he has the most potential. I mean, like, he destroyed the crowd out of Falcon in that movie, right? In Ant-Man.
I think he kind of got lucky more than actually won that fight. He escaped.
I think what I'm saying is his ability, you pair his ability with someone who's a better fighter, mm-hmm. and it'd be amazing. Like Daredevil, they could do that. It would literally be unstoppable.
Okay, well, sure, yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
I mean, I want to be very clear. I still think the Ant-Man character is dumb. like super, super dumb. Like the dumbest Marvel hero right. of all time.
Would you think of like him being in Infinity War flying on an ant towards Thanos? I would literally want to laugh at that. That's really dumb.
It's so dumb. That movie was excellent. That movie was better than it had any right to be.
Because it embraced it, right?
Because it was like, yeah, dude, this is dumb, right? Let's go for it.
I think that a movie like Guardians paved the way for that, right?
Because
Guardians
yeah.
was like, you can be a superhero and be totally goofy, and it's okay.
Right, and it's outer space, so you don't know, right. whatever. Right. It's funny. Yeah, so
and it's
so,
Paul Rudd, so it's just going to be funny, right?
Yeah, so I don't know how they managed to pull off Ant-Man.
Anyway,
because, God, that character is so stupid.
It is.
So stupid, Jason.
The Wasp actually makes way more sense in my mind.
I don't think so.
Because the Wasp at least doesn't talk to ants, right?
Well, all right.
Gosh, she might in this next movie, though, because
yeah, right?
they have
Who
this
knows?
Technology. I hope not.
I hope not, too.
The talking to the ants
dumb.
Thing was the dorkiest thing.
It's so dumb. It's so dumb.
Yeah. Anyways, hey, let's talk about games.
I don't think we have time for a topic this week.
No, I think we do. We'll just this will be a quicker topic anyways,
right.
So I think it's good. And my pitch will be fairly quick. Okay, so topic. I want to talk about how we help new people in game design, right? New designers, what are some positive ways that we can help them? It's something that's been on my mind a lot lately, and I just thought it'd be something cool that we could kind of discuss for ways that we could be open to the community, to new designers, and ways to make them feel like it's something they want to do
mm-hmm.
and kind of how to plug them into this, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
First, number one, our show.
Yeah.
Done.
but I mean, that's been our goal from the
right,
very
it's
start.
It's been our goal, and we've gotten positive feedback from people that we do that.
Yeah.
So it's obviously something near and dear to our hearts that mm-hmm. we want to make sure we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, like just dealing with new game designers, like at conventions or mm-hmm. that you meet at unpubs and things like that. What do we have for tips for that, for how to do that?
Mm. Is this tips for experienced people to approach noobs, or is this tips for noobs to get into it?
I think this is, because we've talked about that before. So I think the second piece. So I think this is tips for how we personally go out of our way to assist new game designers, right?
Okay.
I mean, like, number one would be willing to try their designs, mm-hmm. right? Even if they're, like, really poorly formed and not great because mm-hmm. they just don't know, for instance. Like our first designs that we tried, we were like, wow.
Rough.
This is really rough. Like, this is, you know, there's a lot of problems with this. But being open to trying those things, because mm-hmm. knowing that we still make those designs sometimes, right?
Yeah, sure.
So I think that's a really positive number one, right? Is mm-hmm. let's be open to try their stuff, to be
sure.
willing to give them feedback. And I think when you're giving feedback with a new person, you need to try and gauge their level of constructive criticism they can handle.
Mm-hmm.
as a designer, because mm-hmm. I mean, you have to have tough skin to be a designer. Absolutely. But you can build that up over time, right? Like somebody saying they don't like one of my designs now makes me feel a lot less bad than somebody saying that like when I mm-hmm. first started.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Giving constructive criticism, but direct constructive criticism.
Yep.
You know, I think along that perspective, it's important to not, cause you don't want to make anybody feel bad, you know? You don't want to make anybody feel bad by saying, oh, that's not a good idea. But it's important to be helpful, you know, and to be honest, because if you're not honest, then nobody's going to learn anything, you know? So it's important for experienced designers to, after they do that play, you know, test the new person's game. It's important that they give honest feedback, that and identify the problems that might be there and not just identify problems, but help work out solutions to those problems.
Right. Right. Brainstorm with them.
Yeah.
And by all means, don't be so nice that you're not pointing out the problems, because mm-hmm. that doesn't help anybody, you know? Mm-hmm. You don't want to be the person that enables that really terrible singer friend you have who went on American Idol and looked stupid.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to be that guy in the game design. Like, oh, this is great. Go pitch this to a publisher, man. Like,
yeah.
Don't do that, you know?
Right.
I think giving them tips on prototyping is probably always good, because, you know, and maybe one of the things that I found with a lot of newer game designers I've seen, and this was my problem at the beginning too, especially, was helping them break down their game and figure out if they actually made a game or they made like three games, right? Because that was something that I know we've seen new designers. Like I said, I know I had this problem too. I over-design a game and put too many like, and then also you can do this, and then also you can do that. And it's like, wow, that sounds like three really good games, or maybe two good games and one that you should not do. Like, not one huge game, right?
Yeah.
So I think helping them discover the core of what makes their game fun, mm-hmm. right? To find mm-hmm. the fun in their game.
Sure.
I think that's important for a new designer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, any tips you can pass along for, hey, this works for me, this is mm-hmm. what I try and do. I think encouraging them to start smaller. I mean, I think there is some game designers who their first game might be a huge epic game and it's going to work. But I think as a good tip, if I was talking to somebody who wanted to get into game design, I'd say, think of a simple card game you want to design, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And start from there and then build up from there. Because it's so easy to get lost in the weeds. I think I would tell them to try and focus on as few games as possible, but not be afraid to explore.
Mm-hmm.
And don't be tied down to any one idea. Know that your best idea to you may be one that you throw away
mm-hmm.
and never sees the light of day
mm-hmm.
and just be okay with that. You're going to have white whales. You're going to have those games you desperately want to make that just never work. Right.
Sure.
And that's happened to both of us absolutely. More than twice.
Yep.
And there's still games that I think about like, oh gosh, I want to work on that game.
Mm-hmm.
No, don't work on that game. It's a lost cause. So, you know, I still, every once in a while, look back at notes and think of an idea and be like, oh, I'm excited about that. And I'm like, no, you're not. You're just excited because you're reading it right now. If you start working on this, you're going to want to set it on fire again. So don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's some thoughts on things you can do to help new game designers. You know, encourage them to go to events like Unpub, I think. Mm-hmm. It's really good. Knowing that, unfortunately, at Unpub, you sometimes will get really jerky people. Like, we've run into that experience of other game designers that aren't so nice to people. And I know I ran into that where we talked about that with Poison Players.
Yeah.
Where, you know... But those are the type of things you want to warn people about, right? Mm-hmm. Like, hey, understand that some people are just going to hate your game, and that's actually a good thing. Mm-hmm. Because there are people that have hated my games, and I've thought, I'm glad, because I look at the type of games you like and you want to play mm-hmm. and you design, and it's not my thing.
Yeah.
And so the fact that you dislike my game just tells me that you're not in my target audience, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Look for commonalities in your feedback that you're getting if you're new.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess that's from the other side of the perspective. We're talking about us giving feedback, you know, or us, what we can do. I think those are all pretty good things. Also, I think having new people play your prototypes, right? So mm-hmm. that they can see that it kind of demystify it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, look, it's not this crazy hard thing to mm-hmm. do, you know? Designing games isn't easy, but it's also incredibly accessible to people.
Yeah. And that was the kind of thing that I was going to say is that, don't just talk about your designs, don't just talk about their designs, talk about your designs,
yep.
talk about decisions you've made, talk about decisions that other designers have made and yep. other games that they may have played and talk about, you know, pick a game that you really like, that you really think is really exciting and think about, and let's talk about the decisions that that designer made in making that game
right.
and what can we learn from the choices that that designer made to make that a compelling experience, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
One of the other things that this took me a long time to get my head around, and I wish that somebody had just said to me early on, like, this is how this works. You're wrong. Which was, I would look at somebody like a well-established designer, say a Pinchback and Riddle or a TC Petty or somebody who's several games out there, or even like a Katarsky, right? Several mm-hmm. games out there, you think we look at them and we're like, especially when we were starting out, right? Before we really knew them very well, like,
mm-hmm.
oh my gosh, like, how do they do that? Like, I mean, it's a little less, I would say, with Riddle and Pinchback because they're a team, right? So there's two of them, right? So you know they're getting ideas from one another.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I'm just like, it's like you just crapped out a perfect game. Like, how do you do that? And then like, you start to get to know those people and you play the early prototypes and you're like, okay, no, you didn't. Like, so that's one piece of it. But the other piece of it, I feel like, that I would tell a new designer that I wish that I know, and was that you're going to get some of your best ideas for your game from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Sure.
Because like, I remember thinking like, gosh, this mechanic is going to be the mechanic that makes this game. And I had nothing to do with coming up with it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I designed a game and then somebody said, it'd be cooler if it did this. And you're like, oh, that changes the game. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually felt like depressed about that a couple times when it happened. Like, man, this game is going to be cool now, but I didn't feel like I didn't design it, but, mm-hmm. but you did. People gave you feedback and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that maybe it was just me that felt that way, but I don't know. Did you feel that way? Like if somebody was like, here's the greatest mechanic for this game. And you're like, oh my gosh, it is, but it wasn't your idea. Did that bother you or no? Was that just me?
Yeah. Well, I have worried about that. And I still sometimes worry about that. Yeah. Saying that, you know, it's a really good idea, but it didn't come from me. So is it fair for me to use it? And I think in the end, and that's an instinctual thing for me. I don't want to take credit for somebody else's work, you know, but in the end, anything given as feedback in the context of feedback about the game you're making, I think is something you need to pay attention to and you need to listen to and you need to really, truly consider. And
know that it's okay to use that. And
yeah.
then, hey, give that person a credit in the playtester thing or a special thanks or,
you know,
I mean, something. You want to make sure that if you can put that person in the rule book or something if it ever gets actually published. But
yeah,
I mean, don't feel bad about taking great ideas from other when they're offering you ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Don't feel bad about taking those. That's,
sure.
you know.
Sure.
Yeah. The other thing I think is just from that same thing is explaining to game designers that like new game designers, they're mostly not new mechanics.
Yeah.
You're going to lift mechanics from other games. And you just need to realize
okay.
that's cool. Like,
yeah.
I remember feeling really guilty about that in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like, oh gosh, I feel like I just totally stole this from this game. But like, yeah, you took a mechanic from another game. Four other designers who were published probably did the same mm-hmm. thing with that same game.
Yeah.
Because that's just how it works.
It's incredibly rare in the history of game design to come up with entirely new mechanics from scratch.
Right. Right. You know? That aren't influenced by anything else.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. That's almost never going to happen.
Right. And yeah. it does sometimes, but I mean, it's not common. And right. we've talked before about how that's not always a good thing because those truly unique mechanics aren't familiar.
Exactly.
They can sometimes be very hard to understand and explain.
They can be off-putting.
So yeah. Right. yeah. Anyways, I think that covers that.
Sure.
So
yeah.
If any other listeners have any thoughts about like you're a new game designer, you wish someone had told you this, you're an experienced mm-hmm. game designer, you wish somebody had just sat you down and said X or done whatever for you.
Yep.
I'd love to hear the feedback on that. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that'd be super digital.
Indeed. Super digital. So, all right. I'm going to pitch a game here.
Please do.
So, all right. So here's the idea of this game. I was trying to think of a game and I was trying to think of something kind of unique and different.
And then you failed.
Well, I failed at my original idea, but then I came up with a different idea that I feel like is unique and I'm sure I'll never design. But I like the idea. So I was trying to think of, I was thinking like, well, I want to make a word game. I've never made a word game. I want to make a word game. I don't know why. Oh, because we've been playing Codenames. That's why. So mm-hmm. I was like, oh, Codenames is the word game. Make a word game. I was like, but what would be like a different kind of, like, what would be an interesting thing to make a party game out of, right? Spoiler alert, this is not the game I designed, but this is how I got there. So, I was like, all right, what about words, word dungeon? What if it was like a dungeon crawl, but you were using words somehow to get through it?
Yeah. I mean, if actually, you spell the word hit, then you hit something.
H-I-T, hit. That's like every show my son watches. So, super good job, super readers. But anyways, so anyways, I was just trying to think of like a party game style, like dungeon crawl. That might be kind of fun.
Sure.
But then I couldn't think of anything. So, but that led me to my next thing. So here's the setup for this game. All right. We've got a bunch of people, old people, these old people. They live in a retirement community in Florida, right?
Okay.
By that, I mean one of those like mobile home trailer parks they live in, but like they're like fancy, you know? Okay. They got the single wide trailers, and then there's like a big swimming pool and like some shuffleboard courts and stuff, and you know, they ride around in the golf carts and stuff, and it's pretty amazing.
Sounds like a sweet place.
It is. So, you know, like I wish we like just all lived there like as like regular adults, not old people.
They play canasta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shuffleboard too. Shuffleboard is amazing. So, all right, so there's that, right?
Mm-hmm.
so I was thinking about, this is kind of the setup for the game. You are playing as these characters that live there, but these aren't just any characters. Like, this particular park is populated mostly with, like, old war veterans.
Okay.
And
the game's called War Stories.
It's not.
Oh, okay.
I hate you. It's called Word Stories. I'm just kidding. No, so these people are living in this trailer park, right?
Uh-huh.
But they're all kind of surly and old, you know?
Uh-huh.
And it just so happens this trailer park is built over a gate to the netherworld, right?
Okay. This is getting better.
Specifically a dungeon in the netherworld, right? Okay. Netherworld, right?
Yeah.
And this gateway at the beginning of the game is opened and creatures are going to come pouring out, right?
Uh-huh.
And these surly old people are going to have to take care of this, right?
Sure.
Which brings me to the name of the game, which is Dungeon Curmudgeons, right? So,
all right.
So I came up with a name and actually made the game around that.
Okay.
I was thinking
that's,
words
I'm with you.
So,
I'm
okay.
With you here.
Okay, so these old people, right? So here's how the game is set up. There are 9 tarot cards, right? And those make the
what
map.
Cards?
Tarot cards?
You said
I might have said tarot cards. Sometimes
tarot. I love it when you say that. Yeah, sorry. It's funny.
Tarot cards. Anyways, yeah. There's 9 of those, right? And each one of those has 2 mobile homes on them.
Okay.
2 trailers, except for the center one, which has the swimming pool, the shuffleboard courts, and all that jazz, right? So the beginning of the game, you set that up, and it's a set thing. It's not randomized. I mean, I guess it could be. It really doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay. Or it could just be a board.
It could be. It could totally just be a board. I think of card games, right?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So, but it could totally be a board and that would work.
Okay.
Okay. Each of the houses has a person living in it, right? They're a unique character in the game. Mm-hmm. Now, you're not actually going to be any one of those characters. We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
But every turn, what's happening is creatures are coming out of the netherworld, and they're coming to different places in your mobile home park. So on the creature card, it will actually show you a symbol as to where they're going to go. And the 8 tiles are accessible with the swimming pool not being accessible. Okay?
Okay.
So that's kind of a safety zone, right? So these outside places on every turn, depending on what's happening on the turn, X number of monsters are going to come out. Okay. I'm honestly not 100% sure what will determine that number, but you'll flip a card over and be like, okay, he goes to card 1 or slot 1, slot 2, and they just kind of stack up behind one another, right?
Okay.
So you can end up with too many in one area. But this was the co-op game. I forgot to say this, but this is actually a co-op game. Okay. And the way the game is going to, what's going to make the game end is when the residents not just beat the monsters, because they're trying to hold the monsters back, right? But when the residents actually take out the boss, the dungeon boss, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this dungeon boss is like a Cthulhu-style monster. And he's going to show up in your swimming pool, because that would really ruin your day, right?
Sure.
So he's going to show up in the middle. Now, all the monster cards in this boss monster card are regular size cards. They're not tarot cards.
Mm-hmm.
Tarot cards.
Tarot. Okay.
So he would actually sit right in the center. Now, based on how hard you want the game to be, kind of like Forbidden Island, where you would set the level of the water to make it harder. You haven't played it, but you can basically set the water level higher. It makes it harder to win. decide how many cards you want to count down into the deck. So you can count down 0 cards or 5 cards or 10 cards. And you take those cards off. These are monster cards. Take them off. And then shuffle the boss into the rest of the deck, right?
Okay.
You could also do it in reverse. And if you wanted it to be really challenging and say, take the bottom 20 cards off and shuffle the rest. So he could be the first card that shows up in the deck, but you don't know. And once he's there, the safe zone in the center is gone and more bad things happen. But eventually you need him to show up so you can take him out, right? So your job is to control the residents, to move him around. So how does that work? Well, I stole an idea from Phantom of the Opera. Because I had just been looking at that. So in Phantom of the Opera, when you want to move your cards, well, I guess it doesn't matter. I'll just describe it for my game. But you've got a deck of old people cards, 16 of them, because one lives in each trailer, and there are 16 trailers. So at any given time, 4 of them will be on the board. And that is a specific old character card. They have an attack value. They have a special thing they do, and they have a movement value. Okay. Nobody has hit points. When you're hit, something happens, and I'll explain that in a minute. But any given time, 4 of them are out. And they all start in their respective houses. And most characters can move 1 tile, right? Some can move 2. Some can move more. There's a dude in an electric wheelchair he can move 2. There's a dude with a golf cart who can go to any tile during the game. He cannot attack. He's terrible at that. But he can move to any tile because he has a golf cart. Because golf carts are super big down there, those things. And the idea is that at any time, you can move your character to the center of the board, that main area where the shuffleboard courts are and the swimming pool, to grab an item card, right? And if you grab an item card from the center, you now have that item card in your hand. You can use it, or you can pass it off. And most of the items are not one-time use. You just have them, like weapons, like a shuffleboard stick or shuffleboard pucks, right? A frying pan, or maybe you made like some armor out of like an old umpire outfit that's allowed you to soak some damage, or, a weed whacker, or your pet poodle, right? Cause everybody's got a pet poodle down there.
Sure.
So those are the type of things you can get to use to help fight back the nether people. So how does that work? So on your turn, so you've got the 4 cards laid out, I apologize. At any given time, you can, on your turn, so like I can pick one of those 4 and use them, and then immediately another one comes out. Next person gets the option, any of those 4 to use them, immediately another one comes out as they get used. After you use them, they go right on the back of the bottom of the deck. They just plop right back down there. They don't. Sorry. I'm wrong. They don't. I changed this, to deal with damage and not having to track it. Right.
Okay.
So they go to a face down pile or another, they go to another, actually it doesn't even matter. It's just a discard pile. Once you use someone, they go to a discard pile. So you basically use them once and then you can't use them again until they come back up in the deck. I broke it. That doesn't work. Let me explain what I'm trying to do.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess they do go back on the bottom of the deck, right? But the problem is if they get hit, right? If one of the monsters does damage to them, then you have to take them and discard them off to the side. But they're not dead. You can get them back because these are like grizzled little dudes. They don't die, right? They just come back. So at some point you can shuffle, and get them put back into the deck. There's got to be some sort of penalty for doing that. But when you do that, that allows you to bring them back. So if you've lost good people and you're running out of the good fighter people, you can do something to force them to come back. And I'm not sure what that is. But yeah. So a couple more things. What happens is on your turn, when you activate someone in a square, they can attack at least once one of the monsters that is in that square with you, right? And it's just a card that's sitting next to it. Once everyone's taken a turn, it's now the monster's turn, right? And when it's the monster's turn, every monster will attack if there's someone in range to attack, which means if there's in the same square, right?
Okay.
So you could attack and then move your guy off a square so you're not in a place where there's monsters, basically. Because the monsters would attack and then they would reset and more monsters would come out. So that way, you know, you could hide in a square and the center tile is always safe until the big bad comes out. But if you're there, they will automatically do damage to you. If you're damaged, you automatically get put in the discard pile until you can be brought back. Now, obviously, there are things that could help soak that. Like armor might say you can take two hits in one turn before you move. If you take less than two hits, you ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe there's just a tough guy who that's his ability, right? He's got some shrapnel or something. It doesn't mm-hmm. care about that jazz. Yeah, so that's what I have so far.
How does combat work?
So, combat is super simple. It's I hit you. Like, there's no rolling for
just,
combat.
So
like,
just auto hit?
Yeah, auto hit, auto damage, depending on the weapon you have.
Okay.
And depending on the damage you take, whether or not you take damage would be based on whether or not you're wearing armor and what that could do.
Okay, so monsters don't move. They just appear at a specific location mm-hmm. and they stay there.
Yes.
What's the lose situation?
So the lose situation would be once there's too many monsters, when a turn ends and there's more than X monsters in a zone, they take over that zone, mm-hmm. right? So anyone in that zone would get discarded, but again, could come back later. But they get discarded and they, you know, that zone though is no longer like it's gone now. Like you've lost it, right? And I would say that if you lose X number of zones, the game ends.
Okay. So in that case, that would be a good reason to use cards for the zones, because yep. then you would flip it over or something.
Correct.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So this has a few hallmarks that are similar to that castle defense game that you had
yes.
a couple of years ago.
So it does, but I was trying to simplify it
yeah,
to solve
yeah.
some of the problems that big game had.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I can tell that you did, because when you started talking about the structure, I was worried. I started to
right,
worry.
Right. No.
But
no.
But yeah, I can tell that you tried to simplify that, so that's good. So, so I still worry a little bit about upkeep with and you know how many monsters do we have out there, and what do we have to remember that they all do something. But if the actions are just that simple,
right.
Maybe I don't need to worry about that. I'm not sure that I see the benefit of that safe zone just yet.
Well, so right now the benefit of the safe zone is I go there to get an item, right?
Right.
Like, so,
okay. But once the boss monster appears, you can't get any more items?
You can. But now,
but
if you stay in the safe zone, he's going to attack you.
Got it.
Right. So, you know, another, you know, and here's another thought. So, that doesn't work either. So what I'm trying to deal with is differentiating between why you will, like, I like the idea of them moving around a bit, but I also understand
the monsters.
Like, no, the people.
Oh, the people. Okay.
No, I think the monsters need to be stagnant. That way
yeah.
that's not hard to upkeep. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you just use the characters when they come up. But I really want to figure out a way to differentiate between the character came up and they were used, and the character came up and they were used, and then they were knocked out of the game for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So can you think of a way we could differentiate between those two things?
Well, you've got, I'm thinking about how you recall somebody who's passed away, right? So you already have this weird supernatural situation going on. So there must be some way to perform a ritual or something.
Well, I was thinking that they're like Clint Eastwood, right? So they don't die. They just like get beat up and they need a round, you know, they need some time uh-huh. to get back into the game, patch themselves up. And
well, you could, I mean, I think you could give that trait to a character, even a couple, but it might be fun to have one character be, you know, the gypsy or the, you know, or what the fortune teller who can do a ritual to recall someone from the grave or something.
What if the pool is actually spring fed from the fountain of youth?
There you go. It's in Florida.
So
sure.
When a character that happens, you have to move that character back to the middle, to the swimming pool. So once the boss comes out, you can't regenerate anymore. So there's
sure.
your lose condition,
yeah.
right?
I think it, yeah, I like that better.
So there's another lose condition, I guess, is you could run out of characters.
Yeah.
So.
And so how long would it take them to move back, to go back to the Fountain of Youth? So there has to be some kind of a cooldown timer on there, right? That when they die, there has to be some period of time where it takes before they're back in the game.
Right. Maybe
because you don't want to have a bunch of standees that you have to slowly remember to move back every time.
What you could do is you could tip the standee over to say that it's down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then a character that moves could move to the center with that character, and then their card goes back in the deck. That easy.
Okay.
So, and I picture that the idea is the Kalfkar character, his action instead of attack would be that He could pick people up. Mm-hmm. He could pass out items to people, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping to try and curb some of the quarterbacking issues mm-hmm. by not having anyone assigned to an actual character, right? And also limiting your options. So you don't have a character sitting in front of you, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a character sitting in front of you. You're picking the character as you go,
mm-hmm.
and you have limited options. So it's not like, I mean, if somebody wants to be a jerk, of course, somebody can always quarterback in a game like this. It's just
in any kind of co-op situation.
There's nothing you can do to stop it. But I feel like also with a game like this, that's supposed to be kind of lighthearted
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and funny, you'd have, that would be less of an issue than a super strategy game where everybody's like, oh, come on, do this so we don't lose, you know?
Thematically, I think this is one of the best themes you've ever come up with. I love this.
Oh, well,
I really love this. I think that's a super fun idea. Yeah.
I mean, I think it would be interesting to figure out a publishing company that would want a game like that.
Yeah, well, I think it's very accessible. I think it's very approachable. Old war veterans in a retirement community in Florida fighting demons.
It's basically the Evil Dead versus old people.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah. I think it's a great idea. Yeah.
So obviously there'd be some stuff to work out for how exactly movement and stuff works and what the benefits of things are. But,
mm-hmm.
I really like the idea of you passing the characters around
mm-hmm.
and you're like, this turn I'm going to use this guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Sure.
I think that's cool.
Sure.
I'd probably have to make it so that movement was a little easier than I have it set at. Yeah.
Hmm.
Because right now, if you could only move one, then theoretically, well, no, that would be okay. But you'd be trying to figure out, like, making sure you can knock out monsters and stuff when they're, so.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to give each player a certain number of action points that they can spend?
Or just to say, here's the actions you can take in your turn. Mm-hmm. Like, you
can do one of each of these.
Yeah. Yeah. This or this, this or this, this or this.
Yeah.
Right. And that's approachable, right? Mm-hmm. I can attack or do a special move. I can move or do something mm-hmm. else. Or
and you can assign all four of those actions to one character, or you can spread them out around multiple characters as you want.
Oh, I didn't think about it like that. No, I was thinking like each time when I took a character, I could do three actions.
But you can only pick one character per turn?
Yeah, so I pick up a character card,
okay,
set it in front of me,
yeah,
take their actions, and then take that character card and do something with it.
Yeah.
Put it somewhere, bottom of the deck, maybe. Because what's cool about that is you really have to think about what you're doing. If
sure.
there are 16 character cards in there, and only four are out at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because now suddenly I have to be like, oh, crud. How am I going to get this guy out and do this?
Yeah, okay.
The other thing would be...
And you'd have to change turn order every round, though, right? So the same person isn't picking first every time?
Well, it wouldn't matter because a new character is always coming out. So as soon as you pick a character and now we're down to three, the fourth one comes out. Because since it's co-op, I don't want to hose anyone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want it constantly to be, you always have a new option.
Right.
So
you always have four options.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So it wouldn't matter. It could just go in a circle and everyone always has fresh options.
Yeah, okay, okay.
Sure, right. Somebody might get a better option sometimes.
Sure, but whatever. Okay, no, I mean, yeah, I'm understanding better now, and I that's great, man. I think there's a lot of potential for that.
Another option would be that I could put a character in front of me, right? Like,
uh-huh.
So there's four characters off of the side here. Mm-hmm. I pick one up, put it in front of me, a new one comes out. You do that. So that's the first round, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then every round, I can either use my character again or put them on the bottom of the deck and take another character and use that instead.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, and then if a player gets knocked out or doesn't go on the bottom of the deck, goes off to the side, we have to deal with that to save
mm-hmm.
that character.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. I think either way is worth trying. See how it feels.
Right.
You know? Because you might get your favorite guy that you really like a lot that you want to do stuff with and keep using him.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I'm thinking like you flock like three old people to a section to fight some monsters and I attack... And then now I go to the bottom of the deck and it's going to be like four or five turns before I come back.
Yeah.
Like that's annoying.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So that might be better. You can either keep on using that guy or you can ditch him to control someone else.
Even better. What if you have two characters in front of you? You can only use one, right? But on your turn, you can swap one out if you want. So they go back to the pile
mm-hmm.
and then you get another one, you know, or they go to the bottom of the deck and then you draw another one. but you can never swap out more than one in a turn. So there are some different ways to approach it, I guess, is what we're learning here. So.
Cool.
Anyways, that's what I have.
Yeah, so, good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
I like it. We got some more emails or something?
We have one email, but it's really long.
Is it?
Like, really long.
Really long? Well, so, we don't want to wait too long to get to
I know. I'm just letting you know. Okay. He even says this is a long email.
Okay. No, let's
do it. So this is from Kelly, and he says, he titled his email, "That Guy You Met at Grand Con." Hey, guys. Oh, this is Kelly.
Hi, Kelly. Yes. Yeah, he's that guy we met at Grand Con. Yeah,
he was a good guy.
He's pretty digital, dude.
So, I hope you had a good Thanksgiving, despite Rob's refusal to drink. I've been meaning to email you for a month or so now. I had a few thoughts on a couple of your prototypes that I played, so I figured that I would send you some unsolicited advice. It's long, rambling, and fairly derisive in that lovely Midwestern way of passive aggression. So I don't expect you to read it on air. Well, guess what, buddy?
This is already pretty wordy.
There's also a challenge question at the end. But anyway, here's the feedback. So I'm going to skim through some of this, and then I'll forward it to you so you can actually read the real stuff.
Yeah, cool.
Rob's Crumbling Castle or something like that.
Oh, boy, that game was bad. That's enough, right? It's terrible. It was
okay,
bad.
So he's got some ideas about dropping cubes and stuff. I will forward those to you since you think it's so terrible.
That was a big mistake. I mean, that was a big mistake.
Jason's Mismatched Mail-In Mania. This is my Postmasters game where you're sending the sci-fi toy pieces to each other.
Oh, yeah.
I actually forgot about that game.
Yeah, I did too.
The hardest part about that game was it's a co-op game that I couldn't make hard enough for people to lose.
Yeah.
So he said, if I remember correctly, there are 5 toys and 3 cards each for 15 cards. If you were to increase that to 6 toys, you would not need to remove a card at the beginning. If you won't be a fan of that, since you do like the card timer, but in doing this, you increase the difficulty, take out the we lose because of one bad unknowable decision factor by doing this, it reduces the likelihood of players starting with 2 pieces of the same toy. He's right about that, because that was a consistent problem. It increases the number of cards at the magazine, which is where you can trade cards in, which increases the difficulty since it takes longer to cycle those cards to come around, so it makes it harder to remember them. You can keep the timing to the 4 count, which is how many times you have to lock a piece in.
Yep.
And if you really want to keep a card as a timer, make a timing card and make that one of the 2 toys. And by the end, actually, we had determined you don't need a card for the timer. Instead, you just say, when you play the first one, the person says 4, the next person says 3, the next person says 2, the next person says 1, and then you lock.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next time it's 3-2-1 and lock, and then it's 2-1, lock, and then it's lock, lock, lock. Every turn you have to lock to make it increasingly difficult. I don't know if I'll work on that for a while, though, just because it was just really hard to make it difficult. So.
Yeah, well, in one of the, you were resistant to adding cards because it took it above that 16 card kind of structure, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this would be adding more cards, but it's not worth trying. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I will take a look at that. Now let's go to the challenge at the end.
Okay.
So, we're going to save this now, Kelly. Because you are actually giving us a challenge on designing something. So,
okay. So we want to do that next time?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
So, all right. But he ends with, well, that's all the inane rambling I have in me for now. Keep up the good work on the podcast, Kelly. Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks, Kelly.
Nice to meet you. You were a fun dude. So,
yep. Super digital.
So, yeah, I will keep that and we will talk about it soon.
Okay.
I also just got notification that Labyrinth is coming to me in the mail from Target.
Hey.
I'm pretty excited about that.
Congratulations.
Yay!
The movie?
No, the board game.
Oh, okay.
It's that sweet board game where you push the blocks around. So,
cool.
Anyways, yeah. All right. I think that's all we got.
Okay, yeah. Boy, I think this is going to be a long one.
I think so, too.
Yeah, all right.
Thanks to Marvel.
Right. Thanks for listening. Call our Google Voice number, 770-TEL-BDG. Email us, buildinggamepodcast@gmail.com. Check out our website, buildinggamepodcast.com. Wait, what did I say? Yeah. BillionGamePodcast.com. Jason has his deal on Water Balloon Washout. 2 copies, $20, free shipping. Buy it for Christmas.
It's amazing.
It is the best. Twitter @PodcastBTG, @JASlingerland, @Poorly_Designed. Like us in all the places that you do that. And we'll see you guys next week. Love you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios. All of the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are property of the Building the Game podcast.
Next time on Building the Game.
We watched episode of Always Sunny after work today before I came over here. Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah, is that show good?
It's really funny. It's like, so like Seinfeld's claim to fame is that it's, I mean,
about nothing.
Well, it's about nothing, but the thing that it did is that all the people on that show are terrible human beings, right?
Right.
They're just the worst people.
Yeah. I mean, even Seinfeld, not a great
not guy. A good person. No. And that's, I mean, that's kind of how they ended it, with them laughing at a guy getting mugged and then them being punished for being terrible people.
Right.
And they deserved it. Always Sunny, they are so much worse than the people in Seinfeld. They're like, they're the worst human beings you could ever imagine. Ever. And it's really funny.